It's just one of the sad states of affairs, or the truths of physics, that all phased arrays will do cross-coupling. You would think that if you build extremely well-constructed feed horns, if each element was a horn, a long-throated horn, a very deep horn, and you put a bunch of them side by side, common sense would lead you to believe that each one of them would transmit a signal straight into space, and there'd be very little cross-coupling. Well, the reality is they do cross-couple. Everything does. The whole idea of an antenna is to send a signal out into space. And to a certain degree, you can control the angles where most of the signal is transmitted. You cannot control the directions in which all of the signal is transmitted from any kind of an element. Even the great big Hoghorn antenna that was used at, can't even think of the name of the place, at Bell Laboratories in New Jersey, where Penzias and Wilson made their experiment. It'll come to me in a minute. Anyhow, this beautiful looking, huge, steerable horn antenna, you would think that all of the energy comes out of there in only one direction. Well, like every other antenna, it's got side lobes and back lobes. Those side lobes talk to each other inside of a phased array. So there's always cross-coupling, and if you spot enough, you've got to compensate. You've got to calculate it and compensate for it, as I see it does. You don't want to just absorb it, because that takes that valuable RF energy, some of it, and throws it, turns it into heat, and you never see it again. K2JJ, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Well, very good, thanks. So they're using some kind of recombiner or combiner network to recycle that RF, to put it simply. Am I on the right track?
W2L repeater system.
There's sort of a yes and a no to that, Doug. Most transmitters, particularly a solid-state transmitter and a tube-type transmitter, not true of a traveling wave tube, but most other kinds of transmitters, the final stage of the transmitter is very close to a constant current generator. Therefore, of the energy you send back into the transmitter will absorb essentially none of it. If the transmitter cannot absorb the reflected energy, what happens to that energy is it hits the final tube, the tube doesn't absorb it, the energy bounces back into the forward mode. So now you've got your primary energy coming out of the transmitter, plus the reflected energy that came down to the transmitter from some other source. Those two signals are on the exact same frequency, but they're in some crazy phase relationship to each other. What Mother Nature does in a situation like that is when you've got more than one source of energy, and either one of them is being absorbed, they add together in a vector voltage manner. And I'll give you an example. Assume that the two signals, the primary signal and the reflected signal, are both of the exact same amplitude. The primary signal is 0 degrees in phase, straight up on the clock, so to speak. And the reflected signal, after reflecting from the transmitter, comes out 90 degrees in phase, 3 o'clock on the clock, so to speak, on a vector diagram, on a polar diagram. Mother Nature adds those two together. The net result will be a 1.414 volt signal, because they're adding in quadrature, 90 degrees apart, and the final phase will be at the 45 degree point. So if I add a arrow that's straight up at 12 o'clock to an arrow that's at 3 o'clock, the net result will be an arrow at 130. This happens whether you're doing it with a polarization diversity antenna. Now, in other words, you've got some horizontal elements and you've got some vertical elements on your antenna, and you're feeding them simultaneously. The phases add in a vector voltage manner. So in that case, I'd have a final voltage of 1.414 volts at a 45 degree angle. Now, if I'm smart enough, I can pre-distort the signal I'm transmitting out of that particular transmitter that's feeding that particular element. I can readjust the phase so that when the two sum together, they come out the phase that I desire. So you don't have to absorb the energy. The re-reflection of the energy happens automatically because most transmitters will not absorb that energy. I wonder if that makes a little bit more sense, Doug. K2JJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, it does, Dick. So they're correcting the phase of the absorbed signal, and eventually everything is getting re-reflected. Is that about right?
Yes. There are ways that you could use a trombone-like device to adjust the length of the cable between the antenna and the transmitter to adjust the phase of that which is being reflected, or that would be a mechanical equivalent, or electronically I can pre-distort. In other words, I can readjust the phase of the signal I'm transmitting to that particular element inside the transmitter itself, or the exciter of the transmitter, such that when the two signals are added together, I come out with the right phase. The example I gave you is an extreme example where the reflected signal and the forward signal were equal in amplitude. In reality, the reflected signal or the cross-coupled signal is usually, oh, let me pick a number, 20 decibels weaker, 1/100th the power. Therefore, the amount of disturbance in phase it makes is nowhere near as drastic as the example I gave. It may reorient your final transmitter signal by plus or minus 10 degrees, we'll say. And if I readjust my transmitter by the right number of degrees, like 10 degrees, I can make the answer come out 0 degrees if that's what I desire. I'm calling that predistortion. You could call it anticipation. I'm smart enough to calculate what's going to happen in the cross coupling, and I'm going to readjust the phase of the signal being transmitted from that element in order to make it all come out right. Back to you, Doug, KQRIW.
Very good, Dick. Fascinating stuff. I guess we shouldn't sneeze at the simple dipole antenna. It's one of the most complicated transmitter facilities that's ever been assembled with huge amounts of power. What are they using for an antenna? Simple dipoles. A lot more complicated, but those are the radiating elements. Simple turnstile dipole. One going north-south, one going east-west for two sets of frequencies. Great stuff. Anyway, I won't keep it thick and let you get on to the next guy here. KQJJ, back to that.
You're on a very fascinating subject here, Doug. In the last couple of weeks, I suddenly realized that what we call a simple dipole is probably, in one way or another, the most ubiquitous antenna mankind has ever created. We all know what a horizontal dipole strung in the trees looks like. We can envision what a vertical dipole suspended from a tree would look like. In the case of a ground plane antenna, you set up a whole lot of wires as the counterpoise, the ground plane radial system, and if you're successful in laying down enough of them, your backyard will look like a sheet of copper. The quarter wave radiator above has a mirror image of a quarter wave radiator below in the reflection from the ground plane radio system. Therefore, you're only constructing half the dipole, but electronically, because of the mirror image, you've really got a full dipole there. So a ground plane antenna is basically a dipole. Dipole antenna is a dipole. The little probe that you put inside of a feed horn to launch signal into the waveguide or into the feed horn is a monopole. The rest of the feed horn is the counterpoise, and by mirror image, it's giving you the other half of the dipole. So from one point of view, ground plane antenna is a dipole. Dipole antenna is a dipole. Feed horns and waveguide to coax adapters are dipoles. All of a sudden, you're going to start asking yourself, well, what is not a dipole? A Yagi antenna is a whole bunch of dipoles strung together along the boom. I'm now having trouble finding out one antenna is not a dipole. I'm going to challenge you on that one, Doug. Name for me an antenna that is not a dipole. You got it, Doug. KQRIW.
Yeah, when you think about it, most things are a derivation of a dipole. Yes, I've been playing around with little probes inside of waveguides lately, Dick. I've got my box of 10 gig parts here have recently come to the surface. So we've been playing with those as well. But, surely in the antenna engineering handbook, there must be something that isn't a dipole.
Yes, even an NFED, an NFIRE as they call them. Is a beverage antenna and is a rhombic antenna a dipole? The end of the rhombic antenna that you feed is sort of a V-shaped dipole. But in that case, it does deviate from a dipole because the arms of the dipole in that case are multiple wavelengths long. And the beverage is another kind of an end fire, and a long random wire has some dipole-like properties. Well, then it's starting to really differ from a dipole. There also are kinds of antennas that are dielectric rod antennas, and there it's starting to deviate a lot more from a dipole. But the basic feeding mechanism of many of these antennas, that which excites the signal in the first place, the probe in the waveguide, the probe in the horn, the probe in the dielectric rod antenna, they start off as dipoles or half dipoles with mirror image for the other half. So I'm slowly concluding that the vast majority of antennas are extreme variations of a dipole. Therefore, as simple and as unexciting looking as that antenna may be, there's a hell of a lot to be gained to study that antenna. My study of that antenna, from a commercial point of view, is to suddenly realize that if I want to make the dipole look like some other impedance, I used to think I had to make a folding structure, a T-match structure, a delta-match structure, a gamma-match structure. I used to think that the various structures I add to the dipole is the best way of adjusting the impedance that I see at the feed point of the dipole. I used to think that. I've come to what I believe is a much higher thinking, about 4 years ago, while doing a particular job in my consulting business. I suddenly realized that the resistive component of the dipole can be made any number I want, from 1 ohm or less to 2,000 ohms or more, by doing nothing more than adjusting the length of the dipole. I'm feeding the dipole directly with, we'll say, twin lead transmission lines. And if I make the dipole short, the resistive component gets small. If I make the dipole long, the resistive component gets large. And I can match anything from 1 ohm to 2,000 ohms easily by only adjusting the length. As simple as that sounds, you'll find very few books that will tell you that in the language that you'll understand. They'll say it in English. Now, I'll admit that when I adjust the length in order to make the resistive component what I desire, with rare exception, there's always a great big reactive component left over. In other words, if the dipole is exactly a half wavelength long electronically, the resistive component will be 72 ohms, and the reactive component will be 0 ohms. That's the starting point. That's the halfway dipole most of us tune for. But if I made a dipole shorter such that it's now 35 ohms of resistance, because I want 35 ohms, I've made the dipole shorter than resonant, therefore it's a capacitive reactance. And maybe the capacitive reactance is going to be 300 ohms. So in the process of making it go from 72 ohms down to 35 on the resistive component, depending on the diameter of my wire, I picked up 300 ohms of capacitive reactance. If I put an inductor of 300 ohms of inductive reactance in series with the feed point, I canceled the inductive reactance, and my whole antenna is now resonant at 35 ohms. And that works, and I've done that. Now, lucky for me, in the particular environment I work in, most of the time I want the resistance component to be higher. Therefore, I end up making the dipole longer than half wave in order to make the resistive component higher than 72 ohms. 100 ohms, 150 ohms, and 300 ohms are the popular numbers that I use for a particular application. Therefore, with longer antennas, where the antenna itself, the dipole, is inductive, I can correct for the inductive reactance by simply putting a shunt capacitor across the center. Now, in theory, to do it exactly right, the capacitor in the center should be series capacitors, not shunt capacitor. In both cases, you cancel the inductive reactance. But when you do it in shunt instead of in series, you end up with cross-coupling. It's now a reaction between the resistive component and the reactive component. I could say interaction between the length that gives me the resistive component I want. So as long as I'm willing to readjust length and the capacitor in the center, I can make it all come out right, even though there is cross-coupling. A little bit, you got to take two or three more steps to make it come out right. However, a simple shunt capacitor is much more convenient mechanically. When you're doing it at microwave frequencies with strip line, That shunt capacitor in the center, in my case, is nothing more than a piece of scotch tape laid across the center of the dipole. This is a printed circuit dipole at a microwave frequency. And by laying another piece of copper on top of the scotch tape, I'm making a capacitor. And by depending on how much scotch tape I, how much copper tape I lay down on top of the scotch tape, I'm tuning the capacitor. It's an extremely high tuned capacitor, very tunable by in exact number of picofarad I desire, by peeling away just the right amount of the copper tape that's on top of the scotch tape. I think you see where I'm going here. So with a very simple tuning procedure by putting pieces of copper tape near the tip of the dipole, I'm changing the electrical lens. By adjusting the length of the copper tape in the center of the dipole, I'm adjusting the capacitor reactance. And when I balance the two, I end up with exactly the number of resistive ohms I want and no reactive ohms left over. Very simple tuning procedure once you learn it. I put this as an article in Tom Williams' website, WA1MBA.org, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha.org. That's Tom Williams' microwave website. If you look at the bottom of his first page, you'll see an article by K2RIW as to how to get perfect impedance match to your dipole. The article is oriented toward making a perfect impedance match to the driven element dipole that's part of your Yagi. And at first you would say, gee, why are you being so exacting? Why are you wasting all that extra effort? And there's an extremely good reason for doing that. A modern-day microwave low-noise amplifier only gives that high performance of low noise figure if it sees an extremely specific impedance, resistive component, and reactive component. Normally, you adjust that low noise amplifier while it's connected to a pure 50-ohm automatic noise figure indicator. So you've made the preamplifier work perfectly the way you want it to into a 50-ohm resistive source. If the driven element of your Yagi that you're now connecting that low noise amplifier to, and you intend to do moon bounce, and therefore you want the best possible performance, if the driven element of your Yagi isn't 50 ohms resistive, then your low noise amplifier is not going to give you anywhere near the performance you have paid for and carefully tuned for. Therefore, there's strong motivation to make the driven element of your Yagi exactly 50 ohms resistive. And by that tuning procedure I just described to you, that's described in that article also, you can easily get there. It'll take you 10 minutes of your life to do it once you accept it as a problem and once you accept the concept of doing the tuning. I wonder if this makes some sense, Doug. I'm going to use you as an example as to whether or not I've conveyed the idea. K2JJ, K2LAW in the Tech Net.
We got a question, Dick, K2KY.
I'm going to go to your question right after Doug. Doug first.
Yeah, very good, Dick. It makes perfect sense, and I wonder how many slings and arrows you suffered from that article. I imagine there were quite a few non-believers out there, but one of the beauties of a dipole when you start shrinking it, well, yeah, the devil is in the details of the impedance matching. Once you get over that, you know, you can put up dipoles and people say, that'll never work on 80 meters, never work on where it's too short. Well, guess what? You can do it. Go ahead and pick up, Mel.
A loop antenna, not a dipole, but you change it.
We'll get there in the center. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, I was going to say, how do you categorize the loop antenna that I have up here? 272 feet of continuous wire. Start at the shack, then you up, go around four supports, come back to the shack just basis. And we put that, how do we put that in what category? Do we say that's the dipole, Dick, with no splits over?
Well, your particular loop, the one you got in your backyard, Mel, to my knowledge, is a full wavelength. And so I could call that a half wavelength dipole, and two of them mounted above each other. In other words, you know the way you feed a, stand by for a second while I type this in there, you know the way you feed a cubicle quad antenna, a cubicle quad could be considered a bent dipole on the lower half and a bent dipole on the upper half. And the dipole itself, the fact that you bent it and didn't make it straight out, is an extremely minor perturbation as far as the overall pattern and tuning is concerned. So there's nothing magic about the dipole being out straight. You can zigzag it, you can curve it in various ways. And a cubical quad is an example of that. Now, you've taken the driven element of a cubical quad and you've laid it parallel to the Earth. And the cubical quad antenna, let me think now, the way it wants to radiate. That's a complicated question. Depending how you look at it, you get all kinds of radiation out of it. It is a kind of a double dipole, in my opinion, Mel, your loop antenna. When you make the loop smaller and smaller in diameter, as you've done with the one in your shack, you have to work a little bit harder at re-resonating it. And you've got a tuning capacitor on yours to re-resonate it. But no matter how small the dipole is, and Doug was giving us a hint of that, he can take a dipole that is much too short, even for 40 meters. And if he's got enough tuning capacity in his antenna tuner, or the equivalent, he can use it on 80 meters, and he can use it on 160 meters. Common sense would lead you to believe that when the dipole becomes extremely short in length compared to a half wavelength, you would assume that the effective capture area got smaller, you would assume that the gain got smaller, and you assume that the effectivity of the antenna got smaller. Those three assumptions are almost dead wrong. Once you resonate a dipole-like structure, the magic of resonance is that it reestablishes electronically the full electrical effective capture area within half a dB. When you go from a full half-wave dipole down to an infinitesimal length dipole that you were smart enough to resonate, you lose half a dB of the 2.14 dB of gain over isotropic that a full dipole has, and that's all. You may have a dipole that is 1% of the right length. Common sense would lead you to believe it's got 1% or even smaller effective area. It's going to have 90-some-odd percent of the effective area once you resonate it. Once you recognize that principle, you can use it to fantastic advantage. You've set up your dipole at 60 foot of altitude in your backyard, and you've oriented in such a way that broadside is to your buddy in London that you want to talk to. And then all of a sudden, after you put that dipole up, you look across the street and say, gee, boy, am I unlucky. Directly in that direction is the Con Ed wire that's exactly 60 feet off the ground, directly in front of my dipole, and it's going to shadow that signal I'm trying to send to London. Once you study what's going on, you'll be amazed. That dipole of yours, on a sunny day, the sun shines down on the dipole, it's 80-meter dipole, full length, and it's creating a shadow on the ground that has a total area of about 1 square foot. The electronic area of that 80-meter dipole is 8,500 square feet, and I'm not kidding. I can show you the mathematics. I can trace that one essentially back to the Bureau of Standards. 8,000 square foot is the effective area of your dipole, even though the wire has an area of only 1 square foot. The magic of resonance gives you all that extra length. That Con Ed wire that's at the exact same altitude in the direction of London, unless you're extremely unlucky, it is not resonant at 80 meters. It is going to cast a 1 square foot shadow onto your dipole, which has an area of 8,500 square feet. You've got 8,499 square foot left. You're in extremely good shape. You may be a little bit unhappy someday about the sparking and arcing that goes on with the insulators on the Con Ed wire, and maybe it's going to give you some QR Nancy, but it's not going to have any measurable effect on the gain of your antenna, even though they're both the exact same brand of wire. It could be the exact same diameter of wire. They're at the exact same altitude, but one of them has electronically or mechanically been resonated at 80 meters, and the other was not. And the one that is not is essentially transparent. In my mind, that's magic, once you understand the truth of that concept. Somebody had a question along the idea here of loops and dipoles or whatever. A person, whoever that was, please repeat your question. Start with the call letters of name. K2RIW, my name's Dick.
Hey, Dick, it was me, WK2B. You pretty much answered my question. I guess the loop is sort of like a dipole in some respects, but it sort of acts the opposite of the dipole when you go go off frequency with it, but I guess no matter how you resonate in your antenna, whether it be with an antenna tuner, external subs, whatever, as soon as you hit resonance, you achieve that that large electrical surface area. I guess it doesn't matter how you do it, but I guess depending on the coax or the type of feed line you're using, you get more loss if the antenna tuner is mounted in a shack, but I guess it's an interesting concept there. Rebecca, you think it's a change in it?
You've got it, Joe. The magic of resonance is really a subset of what a dipole or what an antenna is in its entirety. You could take your favorite electronic engineer, your buddy who thinks he really understands electronics, and I posed this puzzle to quite a few of the people I met at the microwave update in Philadelphia a month and a half ago. Here is 150 guys representing about 9 or 10 countries and about 20 states in the United States and Canada and a few other places. Here's a real good group of hardcore microwave enthusiasts at the microwave update that I was at. And I posed this little puzzle not to make anybody feel intimidated, just to demonstrate a principle. I posed this little puzzle to them. And the puzzle was the following. And you can try this on your buddies, and you're going to get an awful lot of fun out of it, and it's an educational experience. As long as they stay friendly with you, and once they realize that you're not trying to intimidate them, you're just trying to teach a principle, you can try this puzzle. Here's the puzzle. You have a full half-wave dipole. It's been running for 10 solid minutes, steady state. It's a 72-ohm impedance dipole with no reactive impedance to it. You're feeding it with 72-ohm twin lead. So the signal you're sending down the twin lead, 72-ohm twin lead, the 72-ohm dipole, nothing's going to be reflected. So it's nice and simple. And you're slowing down time, and you're watching what happens. Your transmitter is putting out a sine wave. At the instant the positive peak of the voltage comes out of the transmitter, you decide to watch that portion of the wave as it goes down the twin lead transmission line. So you're watching the positive peak. You watch it propagate down the transmission line. You watch it hit the dipole of the antenna. It goes around the corner at right angle, so to speak. And at the instant it has turned that corner and has gone a 16th of an inch down that dipole of the wire, you ask your buddy, okay, what happens next? You'll be amazed what you'll see. You'll get a look on their face like a deer in the headlights. And they'll say, gee, I've never thought about that. I said, well, it's time we think about that. The signal is not reflecting back down the transmission line. It's only going in one direction. There's no standing wave ratio on that transmission line. It's a perfect system, so to speak. The signal has just left the transmission line, just jumped onto the wire of the dipole antenna, and what happens next? A high percentage of the guys will say, well, the signal propagates down the wire and gets radiated in space. They think it simply jumps into space. And it's not electrons that are jumping into space. It's those photons of electromagnetic energy. I won't go there right now. They think the signal just starts going down the wire and jumps into space. Absolutely not. It turns out radiation is quite hard. You have to kick that signal in the tail 30 times in a row. That signal propagates down that wire. 90-some-odd percent of that signal is left when it gets to the end of the wire and finds the egg insulator at the end, and it sees an open circuit. A signal seeing the open circuit, every bit of it reflects back without phase reversal. The signal comes back to the feed point in the center. It took a quarter wave in time to go down to the right-hand side, took a quarter wave to come back. By then, the transmitter is putting out negative voltage. So the positive wave that went out and most of it comes back hits the negative wave that's now coming out of the transmitter and transmission line. It thinks it sees a short circuit. It then re-reflects forward again and goes back toward the egg insulator. That signal bounces back and forth 30 times, and you could say, in round numbers, 1/30 of it is radiated on each bounce. What you and I call resonance is to make sure that all of those bounces stay in step, stay co-phase. If the antenna is a little bit too short, the signal comes back from bouncing off the egg insulator at the end, it comes back a little bit too soon. It comes back leading in phase. Call that the capacitive antenna, leading in phase. or if you make the antenna a little bit too long, it starts lagging, and it comes back a little bit late. We call that lagging in phase, and we say the impedance of the antenna has an inductive reactance. The fact that the antenna will so rapidly develop capacitive reactance if it's short, or inductive reactance if it's long, all of these years it has been telling us that the signal is bouncing back and forth on the wire. You have to kick that signal in the tail 30 times before it finally gets radiated. Radiation is hard. It's difficult. You got to get it just right if you want it all to happen the way you want it to. None of the books I can read, and I own probably 40 books on the subject of antennas, feel for what the heck is really happening here. Once you realize that resonance is lots of bounces, and when you make the antenna shorter and shorter, and you re-resonate it electronically, instead of there being 30 bounces, it takes 50 or 60 bounces as you make it shorter and shorter, and eventually 100. That's the mechanism by which the reactance builds up more rapidly as you get off frequency. That's a fancy way of saying the antenna is a higher Q, or it's got a narrower bandwidth. You can make the dipole infinitesimal as short as you want, but it's going to become more and more narrowband after you've impedance matched it, after you've re-resonated it electronically by putting the right kind of inductors and capacitors on it, so to speak. So the disadvantage of making the antenna too short is that it becomes very narrowband. Your QSY 100 KC and you got to retune everything. Maybe 10 KC and you got to retune everything. That's the disadvantage, but once you've properly tuned it, you come back to essentially all the same radiation efficiency and almost the identical pattern. But you've got to recognize what's going on with all these bouncers. I haven't read that in any book that I respect. I haven't read it in any book. But I'm almost positive that's what's happening. All the evidence is there. I could give you two or three more pieces of evidence, but I think you see the point. Now, I probably created a couple of questions by this little discussion. If so, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2ND.
Barry recognized. Anyone else?
I use that at the seminar Wednesday at Telephonic Service at WJ2B.
That's your FXR. And Mr. FXR recognized. FXR, J2B. Okay. Let's see. Joe wants to use it. Barry wants to use it, and this is FXR can use it. Barry first, go ahead with your question or comment, Barry.
Okay. You used the term 30 times. I think, I'm assuming that's an arbitrary number. What do you say is I'm sure it's a diminishing number, but when do you reach the point that you say this is no longer happening?
Barry, I will let you know your audio is very low. I think you set up for the sideband mode and have to readjust it when you're in the FM mode. Don't forget to put it back again. Without a doubt, it's an exponential decay. If I had a cowbell or a... if I'm standing in front of a Liberty Bell and I hit it with a hammer, when can I say the bell is no longer ringing? The bell... once you've excited it with energy, and it's a high Q circuit, that's what ringing really is, and the signal, and the ringing is slowly radiating that energy into space as acoustic waves, and the wave that's left on the bell gets smaller and smaller. It never completely disappears. But at some particular point, it gets so small, you say, I don't give a darn anymore. So it's an exponential decay, just like the E equals 1 minus T over RC, the exponential decay of an RC network. When can I say the voltage is no longer on the capacitor when I'm discharging it with a resistor? Well, that voltage is always there. Beyond some particular point, your digital voltmeter or your oscilloscope no longer sees it, and you say it's gone. So the ringing of a bell, the discharge of an RC network, or the number of times that my original signal that I put on that dipole finally dies out, it's the exact same exponential decay. The good news about the dipole is that while that original signal is bouncing back and forth and decaying, the transmitter is sending out another one right in time with the first one that bounced back, if you know what I mean. So you're continuously supplying them. So although the original signal is going into an exponential decay, if I'm running at 3.5 megacycles, I'm re-exciting the exponential decay 3.5 million times per second. I think you see what's going on here. So it's a simple exponential decay. There is no exact answer. But if your definition is that when the signal is down to 37% of the original, and that's the usual definition of an RC type transmit, and it's down to 37% of the original, I'm going to say that it's gone. You know, Don, well, it's not gone, but that's just your definition. I wonder if that makes some sense before I go on. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, yeah, it does. It does. Now, is there a way to say that the signal is gone? For instance, let's say you disconnected the transmitter from the feed line. Now the RF is looking at a terrible match. It's looking at something when it's coming back down the feed line. Does this mean that it's now being transformed into heat or something else at that time?
A darn good question. And here I'm speculating a little bit. If the transmitter is continuously connected, the signal it reflects back sees almost a pure short circuit because the positive voltage meets the negative voltage at almost the same amplitude. That's a short circuit. And in the steady state, when everything's running correctly, the 72-ohm transmission line thinks the antenna is a pure 72-ohm resistor. In reality, there's a whole lot of bouncing going on that makes it look that way. And by the way, your dipole, if you put a very brief pulse into the dipole, you will get significant reflection on your time domain reflectometer. The reason for that is twofold. One, that the pulse coming out of the time domain reflectometer consists of a whole lot of simultaneous frequencies, and the dipole is only resonant at one of those frequencies. But even if I made a pulse of 3.5 megacycles of RF energy on my 3.5 meg dipole, still I would see reflected energy on the first few cycles until the whole dipole, like a bell, got ringing at full volume, at full magnitude, so to speak. So there's a transient response of your dipole. That's the reason why I said the dipole had been running for 10 minutes steady state response. So it has a finite Q, a finite bandwidth. It takes a certain length of time to go through the rise time or the full time. And so for a period of time, it is the wrong impedance until it comes up to steady state response. By the same token, if I abruptly stop the transmitter, I have in my mind done the equivalent of changing the impedance seen by the end of the feed line that's at the dipole. Therefore, the signal that's bouncing off the dipole back and forth is not going to bounce the same way. Some of that signal is going to go down the transmission line, go back toward the transmitter, maybe reflect off the transmitter, and now you've got a complicated situation going on. The signal's reflecting back and forth in the transmission line. So if you had a directional coupler on the transmission line, at the instant you abruptly stop the transmitter and the directional coupler is looking at the signal coming back from the dipole, the signal coming back from the dipole sensed by that directional coupler into a good oscilloscope or spectrum analyzer would see no reflected energy in the steady state. At the instant I abruptly stop the transmitter, I think the directional coupler is going to see signal. And now you sort of see why I think that's going to happen. If I get a chance, the band better run that experiment. And you created that situation, Barry. And QMB, KQLIW.
I thank you, sir. Okay, I almost didn't make the net tonight. I'm glad I did. Back over to you, and I know there are at least two other people that have some interesting questions. And QMB.
Yeah, I think the next guy was Joe and J2B, WJ2B. You got it, Joe.
I guess what you're sort of getting at, going back to my memory of school, engineering school, I think it has something to do with the impulse response is what you're talking about. Is that correct?
Absolutely right. The so-called transient response or the impulse response in many systems is extremely different from the steady state response. And when you do the complete mathematical solution of a real situation, most of the time you use one set of mathematics to figure out the transient or impulse response at the beginning of the event. You use another kind of mathematics to figure out the steady state response in the middle of the event. And if you're a real thorough guy, you use another kind of transient response to figure out what happens at the end of the event, on the assumption you abruptly end the event, or you think you're going to abruptly end the event. Well, in the case of a high Q structure like a simple dipole, when you think you've abruptly ended it, I guarantee you haven't. It's sort of like trying to unring a bell. You hit the bell with a hammer, and you decide that a second later the event is over, well, that bell's going to keep right on ringing. And now if you grab it with some kind of a damping device, there's going to be some number of cycles that it still goes through even after you created what you think is the end of the event. Life ain't simple. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, all right, you gave me some good ammunition to ask a really good question of whoever the instructor is, I forget who it is, but there's something giving me lecture on Wednesday night, I don't think it's going to be on telephone, I believe it's on microwave filters, I'm not sure exactly, but that should be an interesting seminar there. The president of my company I'm working at gave me an oscillator that
Your company wouldn't be the one that makes oscillators. Why can't I think of his name now? Wait a minute, it wasn't 6 months ago. It was about 2 years ago. There was a beautiful lecture about this mechanical stabilizing section, a system that was being used on oscillators. Is that the same company we're talking about?
I don't think so. I don't know if the does the name Axel Keys ring a bell?
It sure does, and that's a different person than the one I'm thinking about. Okay. I'm very glad you reminded me, Joe, because I signed up for that lecture on Wednesday, and I might have forgotten about it. I intend to be there, but I think we should go easy with the lecturer. These kind of questions are a little bit on the deep side. They're out of the normal range of education and books. And to hit a guy cold in front of an audience of 30 people is a little bit unfair. Unless he's asking for it, and unless it's, you know, it's a jovial atmosphere, and you're saying, hey, here's a joke question, but it does ask a very poignant question. There's probably ways you can pose it, but to just suddenly hit a lecturer with one of these so-called trick questions, and because it is an area that has been so poorly considered up to now, it does constitute a trick question. So I think we should go a little bit easy on them. You now have heard about the so-called skin effect. Skin effect means that the magic of RF energy is that it only goes down into the copper surface a very short distance. Never gets a chance to get any further than that before the next cycle comes along, is one way of looking at it. At my favorite frequency of around 1 gigahertz, the RF energy in a piece of copper goes down a depth of approximately 1/10,000th of an inch. That's all. The first 1/10,000th of an inch conducts the vast majority of all the current at 1 gigahertz in pure copper. Therefore, if you're using a piece of 30-gauge wire, and if a piece of 30-gauge wire, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, is good for 1 ampere at 60 cycles. And by the way, when you go to the exact formula, you'll find out the skin depth is 1 over square root of frequency. So as the frequency becomes lower, and you take the square root of that number, and you take the inverse of it, it'll give you a ratio. So I'm down at, instead of 1 gigahertz, I'm down at 1/100th of 1 gigahertz, would be 10 megacycles. If I'm down at 10 megacycles, the square root of 100 is 10, I would have roughly 1/1000th of an inch of skin depth. Copper at 10 megacycles is going to be close to 1/1000th of an inch of skin depth. So if my wire is 1/1000th of an inch in diameter, I'm going to be using essentially the whole wire. If my wire is 10/1000th of an inch in diameter and the skin depth is only 1/1000th of an inch at 10 megacycles, you can get a good feel right away as to how much current you can put through that wire. The bottom line is this. You'll soon discover that any reasonable length of wire you're going to use can easily tolerate a kilowatt at, say, 80 meters. If you're using 40-gauge wire and you're trying to put 1,000 watts into it at 2 meters, I think you're in trouble. Your next question is going to be, okay, I now got the two extremes, 80 meters, no problem with reasonable wire, like 16-gauge, 14-gauge. I can put a kilowatt into that easily. But 40-gauge wire on 2 meters, I can't put a gallon into it. I'm probably going to burn it out. And where in between, at least you know some of the techniques by which you can make a rough guess at that. And I imagine if we do enough of a web search, we'll find somebody who's actually gone one step further and really calculated or really did the experiment. Another way of looking at it, as long as your transmitter is reasonably well protected, what are we worrying about? If at worst you burn up the piece of wire, the wire has so little mass to it, with rare exception, it's not likely to start a fire. The worst that will happen if the wire burns up is that the end of your transmission line becomes an open circuit. If the transmitter is well protected, it can protect itself from that high standing wave ratio situation. So when in doubt, do the experiment. It's not going to explode, if you know what I mean. But at least you've got a little bit of more feel for what goes on, I think, Bob. KA2FXR, K2LAW. Rich recognized, but Bob first. Go ahead, Bob.
I know you made sense out of it. Thank you very much. KA2FXR.
Okay. And when you guys find some errors of some of these things I say, it's not going to be too embarrassing. Come back and tell us about the errors. Now, Rich, you got it.
In relation to what the gentleman just brought up, on my kilowatt amplifier with that 10-meter coil, it's actually a 10-15-meter coil, wound out of copper tubing, there's a skin effect there. You think I've got enough cross-sectional area to handle the RF currents in that circuit?
You mailed me a picture of that, and that's the stoochiest looking coil I've ever seen made out of copper tubing. I think you've got belt and suspenders there, Rich. I know you've experienced a little bit of heating in that environment, but I think the heating is because of the way the tap was done, and it was heating at the contacts of the switch that picks off the tap point. That's what I think is going on. I will also admit that depending on the Q of the Pi network, I think it's a Pi network, and depending on how heavily it's loaded and how much signal is bouncing back and forth, you do have another phenomenon. Let me give you an example of that one. I've been doing a lot of answering email from guys that after all of these years are building the parallel kilowatt amplifier. There's a whole bunch of guys in the area of Kansas who have gotten together and decided that they don't care if it's a 1972 article that makes it 35 years old. They suddenly decided in their retirement they want to build a parallel kilowatt strip line amplifier for 432. And they're using all kinds of flaky techniques for shielding the upper box. Let me show you what's going on. You take the 4CX250B2, which is the real horsepower horse that's inside of that amplifier, and it's something like 4.5 picofarads of plate capacitance. When you resonate that at 432, and you properly load it, because you're at a high enough frequency where the capacitive reactance is low enough, 432 megacycles, that the best you can do is you're going to have a loaded Q of 39. The word Q has got about four different definitions. Center frequency divided by bandwidth. Voltage rise at resonance. Current rise at resonance. Stored energy per cycle versus energy divided by the energy dissipated per cycle. Those are the four definitions of Q. But you put it all together, what's happening is that there's a loaded Q of 39 on that amplifier, on that plate circuit, when it's operating correctly. You're putting in 1,000 watts of DC power. The tube is generating at its plate circuit something like 700 watts of power with a multiplication of 39. Therefore, there is 27,000 watts bouncing back and forth in that plate circuit. And your output coupling network is drawing off 700 watts on each bounce. But the real resonator has 27 kilowatts bouncing back and forth. Therefore, when it comes to calculating the shielding requirement of that plate circuit, you think you're putting in 1,000 watts, you think you're generating 700 watts of useful output power. You're not shielding from 1,000 watts, you're not shielding from 700 watts, you are shielding yourself from 27,000 watts. That's what's really bouncing back and forth in that amplifier. It is a approximately a 30-ohm transmission line being used as a resonator. That's what that strip line made out of copper-clad board with finger stock going to the tube is. It's a resonator. It's a half-wavelength-long resonator with a flapper capacitor at one end and a tube at the other end. So you better make sure you're using good aluminum solder and copper or brass screening for the air input holes and the air output holes, because you're shielding yourself from 27 kilowatts. These guys had trouble finding the brass or copper screening, and they were about to use aluminum screening. And they were just going to sandwich it between a couple of strips of aluminum with some sheet metal screws. And I said, I don't recommend that. Your aluminum, of your aluminum screening, the surface is always building up aluminum oxide, which is the world's best insulator. And as such, even though you may think your ohm meter is telling you good news, when it comes to 432 megacycles and 27 kilowatts of it, I don't trust anything except something like copper or brass screening with fine holes and the edges of it well soldered down all the way around in a very low inductance manner to that aluminum top plate. And consider making the top plate out of something else besides aluminum if you're not skilled at doing aluminum soldering. You can see where I'm going here with this. So I'm making strong recommendations to these guys that think twice about shielding when it comes to that kind of power, because if not, you're getting dangerously close to a potential biohazard problem. I wonder if that makes some sense, though, Rich. N2EL, by the way, your voice is sounding better and better. K2LAW in the deck, man.
Okay, Dick, well, thank you very much. Yeah, it does make sense. Now I understand why they say there are high circulating currents in the tank circuit. It's a function of Q, and from what you're saying, you have to multiply the input power times the Q factor to come up with that circulating current?
You're very, very close. The input power you and I put in there is the DC voltage, like in your case it might be 3,500 volts and it might be an ampere. That's the DC voltage you're putting in. The tube itself is using that to generate power. In my case, I put 1,000 watts, 2,000 volts, and half an ampere. I put 1,000 watts of DC power in it, and the tube is capable at 70% efficiency of generating 700 watts. So RF-wise, nobody is generating more than 700 watts. But the 700 watts of generated power is going into a circuit with a loaded Q of 39. So the 700 watts is multiplied by 39, and that's where the 27 kilowatts of power bouncing back and forth is concerned. Resonance really is power bouncing back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor if it's an LC network, or between the ends of a strip line if it's a half-wave resonator, or between ground and the open circuit end if it's an open circuit, a quarter-wave resonator. So resonance is energy bouncing back and forth either in length along a strip line or a cavity or a subtuner. That's what resonance is, energy bouncing back and forth. We can talk about the Q of our dipole. It is energy bouncing back and forth on the dipole before it gets radiated. And in your particular case, where it's an LC high network, the energy is bouncing back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor. But once you know the loaded Q, and once you know the amount of power the plate circuit of your tube, the anode, is generating, multiply the two together, anode power times Q, and you know the amount of power bouncing back and forth in your LC network, and that allows you to then calculate what the current is, and with your skin depth calculation, you can figure out how much of your copper is really working for you, and therefore you can figure out what is the current density in amps per linear inch, or width of inch, so to speak, and you can decide that the number is right where you're not going to get much heating, or no, it's not quite right, and you've got to increase the width of the copper, so to speak. So these things are a little bit more calculatable than the average guy knows about. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. I do have a handle on it now. I understand it. No, and as far as the voice, you're going in a couple of days, it'll be a month, and I'm off cigarettes. And I'm glad to be rid of them because I was really headed to a real serious problem that I think I averted. I haven't seen a throat doctor in another couple of weeks, but things are looking up. Well, I think, thank you again. And, yeah, what you're talking about, I was going to say, with resonance, it's the same as the antenna. The each cycle has to be in phase. In other words, when it bounces back and forth in the tank circuit, each cycle cannot be leading or lagging. Same as the antenna example, right, Dick?
Give the man a cigar. Not you a cigar, but you know what I mean. You've got it. Resonance is energy bouncing back and forth, and if you're above resonance or below resonance, that means the bounces are starting to fall in phase or out of phase with a leading phase or a lagging phase, depending on whether you're tuned low or high. So what you and I call resonance is making sure that all the bounces stay in step. That's what resonance is. Resonance is bouncing energy. I wish it had been explained to me that way a lot of years ago when I was supposedly being taught the subject. There's better ways of teaching it, in my opinion. Okay. I think it's time we probably go to Mel's mailbag. And I wonder if you've gotten any mail this week, Mel. K2KEY. KQRIW.
And all this is K2KEY. All right, shall we open the bag of mail here? I didn't even get a chance to look, not even glance, and so I'm going to take it verbatim here and see what happens. Yes. Oh, you know, I was going to tell you about an improbable interference in a building where a friend of mine all of a sudden says, Mel, and he asked me to please take a look at all of a sudden, well, he doesn't live in that building, was next door, that they look, he's got a beam, and all of a sudden they start picking on him, that there's a kind of noise being generated, a number of different things, like computer speakers, the TV, things fly across the screen. He says, he went and took a look at it, and it comes and goes, and I took a look there. And you know what it was? They changed the elevator. That's why I suspect it looked like switching. They changed the elevator system. It worked on the elevator. They put on this new electronic control.